get into that at another time. Now let's talk about these capacitors on the board. That seems to be a number of the questions. How do you make out what these capacitors are? Pumpers, my father, a couple of my uncles told me that they used to use capacitors marked 0.01, 001, 005, 0.1, things like that. Where did that all go? They can't help us with the capacitor, what they are anymore. Want to explain now how to read a capacitor, Dick, over.
For three sentences, Mel, I'm going to go back to the previous subject, and that is when it comes to resistors, the most popular sizes physical of the resistor is 8-watt, quarter watt, half watt, 1 watt, and 2 watt. I'll repeat that. 8, quarter, half, 1, and 2. You notice that each one of those steps is very close to 2 to 1, except the first step, 8 watt to a quarter watt. So, depending on physical size, in typical Allen Bradley brand, round cased, axial lead resistors, 2 watts was the biggest. That's the one that looks, it's a 1/4 the size of a small firecracker. And the physical size of the resistor, the amount of surface area, tells you how many watts it can dissipate before it gets too hot. So that's where the wattage is coming from. Size is wattage of dissipation. The smaller resistor saves you a lot of space, but it can't dissipate as much power. It doesn't have as much surface area.
You forgot to say that it's from different material, and then the size matters.
It's carbon resistors only.
I'm only talking about carbon composition resistors, Allen Bradley style. That was one of the most popular brands. When it comes to greater wattage of resistors, they come in larger physical size, made with wire wound. And now you can go up to 5, 10, 50, 100, 1,000 watts with great big physical objects wire wound. These are not the typical resistors you're going to find on a printed circuit board of pieces of electronics that are thrown away that we're collecting because the price is right. The individual resistors of the axial lead type, and then eventually we're going to talk about the surface mount types. These are the most popular ones, carbon composition resistors. They either use a dense or a less dense mix of carbon inside, and that's the mechanism by which they make high number of ohms or a low number of ohms of resistance. I'm going to give one last example.
Get away from the subject again.
Well, you talked about the color code. And what the color code is the three main bands of the color code. The first band is digit number 1. The second band is digit number 2. The third band is the number of zeros to be added. I'm going to give you one more example. The 100-ohm resistor is brown, black, brown. 1, 0, and one more zero. A 1,000-ohm resistor would be brown, black, orange. Because orange, red. Here we go. Brown, black, red is a 1,000-ohm resistor because red is one step above brown. Red stands for the number 2. So brown, black, red means 1, 0, and two more zeros. That's 1,000 ohms. So that allows you once you know that theory of how the color code works, once you've got the resistor in your hand, and you put it across the ohm meter, you can say, yes, that's a good one, it hasn't been blown apart. A 1,000-ohm resistor that measures 930 ohms is perfectly good. A 1,000-ohm resistor by the color code that measures 1,000,000 ohms, it's almost blown open, or if it measures 0 ohms, it became a short circuit, and now you've got a bad one. You might want to add a comment to that, Mel.
Comment.
K2KEY, K2RIW.
Right, okay. Now you stay with the subject. As I said, we want to stay with understanding. Let them play with the resistors now for a week. Understanding. Let them take the resistors off the board in different color codes and get used to measuring, being just as you said, fine, very good example of reading the color code and then confirming it that it is correct, the resistor is correct to the meter. that's where we'll leave it, because we're going to leave, I told them, they can't stay up any later than around 10-ish. So I said I'll do my best to jam it in. We'll leave that, and then next week we're going to talk about basic capacitors, Dick. Over.
Coming.
Go ahead, Wesley.
And to Adrian, you forgot to mention most of the young people, they have a problem to find out from which side to read the colors. So that's very important to say what is at the end, what is at the beginning.
Yeah, I like that. Let me drop. The kinds of resistors we're talking about, the so-called Allen Bradley style of carbon composition resistors, the vast majority of them were brown in overall case color, with these two silvery-looking axial leads coming out of them. The color code is three or four bars that are wrapped, three or four circles of paint that are wrapped around the resistor in a circumferential manner. And the three or four bars are usually shoved over to one end. If, for instance, they're shoved over to the left side of the tubular resistor that I'm looking at, you read the closest one to the end first. So if I've got the brown, black, red all shoved over to the left, you read the first brown and then the black and then the red in that order. So you start off with the color bands that are closest to one end. And if there's four color bands, if for instance I had a 1,000 ohm, 5% resistor, there would be four bands, they would be shoved over to the left-hand side, and you would see brown, black, red, gold. That stands for 102, 10 and two more zeros, that's 1,000 ohms, and the gold represents 5% accuracy. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Right, okay, very good. Yes, let them play with the resistance first. You covered the resistance pretty good. And you're going to check the resistors to see what the resistors read on the scale. Remember, you got to take the resistors off one, at least one end off the foot. Well, taking them off anyhow. But try to get them in. You're going to get, because of erroneous readings, because of adjacent connected parts, that'll throw the reading off possibly. It may most likely usually lower. So, okay, play with the resistors for a week. Let me know how you're making out with the resistors. Put them aside all the other parts if you don't know what they are and everything, and we'll discuss them one by one, how a circuit is made up of different parts, and then go on from there. So next week, we're going to do capacitors. So take it over. Continue with the tech test.
Now, Wesley brought up a good point. How do you know which order to read those color bands on a resistor? And they're usually shoved over to one side. That's the strongest clue. Once in a blue moon, some brand X resistor will come along where all three of the colors are right in the middle of the tubular portion of the resistor. The second clue is the colors themselves. In the case of a 5% resistor, 1,000 ohms, brown, black, red, gold, you would know to read them in that order as opposed to the reverse order, because with rare exception, the gold band or the silver band is not used to indicate number of ohms. The vast majority of the time it's used to indicate percentage of accuracy. So when you see a silver or a gold band, 98% of the time, the silver or the gold is the fourth band, and then you know which order to read them in. The reason I say 98% is because, like everything else, there's an exception to the rule. If you're trying to, with a color band, represent a 0.1 ohm resistor, the color code scheme that I gave you up to now doesn't allow you to go there. And with some modern transistorized circuits, you do want a 0.1 ohm resistor. In that particular case, the gold band might be first, but it's a rare one. You might have some comments on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
From what I understand, most of them are finding old equipment that has a lot of half-watt resistors in it, TV sets and all that use standard resistors as you set up the Allen Bradley type. So let's leave it at that. And if they get the components that they don't know what they are, they're going to put them aside, resistors and all, but let them practice with just the basic resistors and getting used to understanding the scales, the ohm scale on the meter, which will be most likely the most used next to the volt scale. So let's leave it at that at this point, Dick. Over.
Okay, now you're going to be checking the resistance of your resistors. And by the way, when the resistor is on the printed circuit board, because 99% of the time there's a whole lot of other circuits connected to that resistor. When you're putting the probes of your ohm meter across that resistor, you're measuring that resistor, that's the good news, but there's a heck of a lot of other circuits that are quasi in parallel with the resistor. I might have a perfectly good 1,000 ohm resistor, brown, black, red, and I put my ohm meter across it expecting to see 1,000 ohms, and I see 150 ohms, and I get that 150 ohms when I put the red and black lead of the volt ohm milliammeter across the resistor with one particular polarity, and I go to the other polarity, and I measure 950 ohms. And you say to yourself, what in the world's going on? Well, if that resistor was in parallel with a diode, for instance, or connected to a transistor, the transistor with one polarity has a certain number of ohms. With another polarity, it's got another ohm, set of ohms. That's why they call it semiconductor. It's one of the many reasons. Diode, for instance, will, when you put your ohm meter across the diode in one polarity, you'll measure a lower number of ohms than the other polarity. Normal characteristic of a diode. So, in order to avoid that problem, you unsolder at least one lead of the resistor so it's hanging up in the air. The fact that the other lead is connected to a zillion circuits on the board, let me drop, doesn't matter. As long as one lead is completely free, and you put your two leads of your ohm meter across that resistor, you'll now really be measuring that resistor. And if it's a normal, good resistor, you can measure it with either polarity of your two leads, and you'll get the exact same answer. When in doubt, just for the hell of it, try reversing the two leads, and if you get a different number of ohms, what you thought was a resistor might be a diode, because they will measure differently forward and back versus backward and forward. And also, don't forget that before you ever use a volt ohm milliammeter, you will connect the two leads together, no matter what scale you're on. You'll connect the two leads together and make sure the needle goes over to full scale deflection, representing zero ohms for that particular range. And if you then flip from the times one range to the times 100 range on your ohm meter, let me drop, you've got to do that zeroing process again. A lot of people forget that. You must zero a volt ohm milliammeter on the particular range scale you're on and adjust, connect the two leads together and adjust that slide switch, or it's a potentiometer. There's a little bit of a wheel on one side of a triplet or a Simpson volt ohm milliammeter. You spin that wheel in order to make it read zero ohm. You're really calibrating it for the voltage coming out of your particular flashlight battery that's inside of that volt ohm milliammeter that makes the ohm scale work. Your particular dry cell battery that's in there, a flashlight battery, a C-cell or a D-cell or whatever. From day to day, the voltage it produces is a little bit different. Therefore, the calibration procedure is going to force you, when you connect those two leads together, to spin that that dial slightly differently in order to zero it. If you don't zero your ohm meter, you can come up with some pretty big errors in what you think you're measuring. You'd be amazed how many people forget that. Wesley wanted to give us a comment. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, actually, you don't have to do it. You don't have to, in most of the situation, free one part of the diode. The Sencor TF-17A, this is very old, 20 years old, probably, transistor FET tester will allow you actually to test also them in the circuit. In most situations, when you have a blown or short diode, you have no resistance either side, you have it shows closed. Now, when you see the sign, then when you reverse the mirror, that there is a difference in the resistance on the meter. Most likely the diode is okay. Back to you.
Yeah, Wesley is now telling us that if you're testing a diode, and it's the next step that Mel hasn't gone there yet. Up till now, he's got us testing resistors on a volt ohm millimeter, and we properly zero the scale. When you go from the times one scale to the times 100 scale or the times 1,000 scale, you've got to re-zero again. When you put those two leads across the diode, and if you put the black lead on the so-called cathode of the diode and the red lead on the anode, you'll measure a smaller number of ohms than when you do it the reverse way. That gives you an idea that the diode has the correct amount of diode action. If you measure something like 0 ohms in both directions, quite possibly you've got a blown out diode. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. We've left resistors. Mel might want to add some more on the resistor measurement and the calibrating of a volt ohm millimeter, the zeroing process. I've seen a lot of people forget that. And even on a digital voltmeter where the zeroing in theory is not required, you better do the zeroing even on a digital meter, because you don't know it, but sometimes the leads themselves have been abused. The lead has become an open circuit, and even though it can give you a good voltage reading, it will not be able to give you a good ohm meter reading. And if you didn't do the zeroing process, even on your digital voltmeter, you could get into a fair amount of misconception. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2MDP.
Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. All right, forget about diodes and all that stuff. We're not up to that yet. Thank God. My God, if you were teaching the class in basic, Dick, you have them already working with, I don't know, Varac, the diodes, or and who knows what exotics to know. Whereas they're only potting out now with teaching resistance. Okay, kids, go to sleep, and all you're going to test resistors only. Anything that you can't read, color codes or anything you don't understand, just put those parts aside. Take whatever you like off the board, and if you recognize it, you want to test it, nothing's going to happen. You can not worry your parents. No shocks or anything going to happen. You know, just be careful when you're unsoldering things not to burn the fingers. Wear the protective glasses, like I mentioned. Okay, solder pops, you know, you don't want it into your eyes. And play with the resistors for a week and all, and then we'll talk about all these other types of devices. We'll get the one at a time so that you can absorb it. But you're going to just test resistors this week and get used to reading the meter. And let me know what you see. Okay, now go ahead. Good night, kids.
Steve, I think it is, KC2MDP. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Yeah, Mel, you're doing a great job. I remember those old days back in BOCES and stuff, and you're doing a better job than most of the teachers I had. Just one quick comment. When soldering, I suggest doing it in a, well, you know, a decent ventilated area. And my comment was, maybe you or Dick might know, is I have this old military meter, and talk about zeroing the scale for ohms. It has the typical 0 ohm scale, but it also has an infinite ohm scale. What's that about? I could never figure out why it has two adjustments on this ohm meter. Back to you.
Yeah, on most volt ohm millimeters, zero, which is far on the left-hand side, infinity, is on the far left-hand side, and 0 ohms is on the far right-hand side. The infinity adjustment on the far left-hand side, I think in most cases, is the little screw in the center of the meter movement itself. You're zeroing that, and on some volt-ohm millimeters, whether you take the volt-ohm millimeter and lay it flat on the table, or set it upright on the table, if they haven't done a real good job of mechanically balancing the movement, the zero will shift. Quite a few of the meters I've used, you set it upright and you adjust the little screw in the center of the meter movement, And with no leads touching anything, and you're in the ohm-meter scale, the infinity on the far left-hand side, you want the needle to be right on that particular point, and you adjust that screw until you get there. And then if you take that meter and lay it flat on the table, all of a sudden that zero shifts, and that can give you some error in the ohm-meter measurements. And then the second step is to connect the two leads together, and on your particular scale, adjust that thumb wheel switch on the thumb wheel until the zero, when the two leads are connected together, works correctly. I wonder if you've seen that effect, Mel, where the meter upright or flat on the table gives you a different, I'm going to call it the zero setting, but it really is the infinity setting. And on the next transmission, I'll explain what the word infinity means if you think it needs explanation. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
I've seen military meters where the ohm meter has actually got an active circuit in it, and it's like a bridge. You short the lead, you set it for zero, you open the lead, you make it read infinity, you short the lead, you make it read zero, you open the meter, you make it read infinity, and it's a pot, not a mechanical adjustment.
Okay, does that mean there's two separate thumb wheel switches in order to do that calibration? Eric, go ahead.
No, it's got two pots. And it's got a scale knob, and it's really balancing the bridge.
Okay, how does the meter know that you're now adjusting for zero, and now you're adjusting for infinity? If you've got two separate pots, no problem. If you've got one pot, how does it know which way to set its internal electronics as you're spinning that wheel? Or maybe what you're telling me is that if it's a truly electronic meter with enough smarts, all you've got to do is touch it and hold it for a couple of seconds, let it go for a couple of seconds, repeat the process. It knows you're doing calibrating, and it does everything automatically. Maybe that's what you're saying. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is just think of an op-amp where you have gain and offset, okay? One's like an offset knob, one like a gain knob. Think of it that way.
Does that mean there are two separate knobs on the front panel of that machine?
That is correct.
Okay, now, I know that Mel is going to tell us we're getting too far ahead of ourselves. We're going into a very modern digital multimeter that uses a Wheatstone bridge with fancy electronics and an op-amp, and that'll do an ohm-meter scale. And Mel is telling these guys to go to Radio Shack or to eBay and buy a simple mechanical volt ohm milliammeter, analog type, Simpson triplet, or one of these more miniature ones if you like, and learn to use it first before going to these fancy digital ones. I'm pretty sure that's what Mel's recommendation is. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I'm talking about a 1945 general radio meter. It's just a signal port.
KC2MDP. Eric is correct. Yeah, this thing is an old analog military clunker. I mean, this thing's got a round dial on it. That's how old this thing is. Back to you.
Very fine, Steve. But still, I think that is a somewhat rare piece of instrumentation. And I think these guys that Mel is addressing, I think there's less than a 1% chance they're going to run into that particular World War II meter, but maybe Mel is more familiar with that instrument. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yes, I have one of them. It's in a metal box thing, a real clunker. Forget about that. They're not going to bother with anything like that. They all went to sleep by now because they're not allowed to stay up this late. So I left it at, we left it at a plane, DOM, and they're going to play with resistance. So that's bottom line. Yeah, as you said, some of the meters, well, after you knock over, like a Simpson, you know, it's standing on your bench and you knock it and it goes down or it falls on the floor, the case starts to look a little bit like battered up because those cases were big, like, so they get cracked up and everything, and eventually that's what you pick up the meter, you lay it down on your bench, and you see the needle move to the, you know, off, up or down. Stand it up, and you adjust it, you lay it down, it's off again. So, you send it back to Simpson, and you got to rebalance those little spring-like things that sit on that arm there. They have a You know, they you can take it apart yourself and do it, but I don't advise unless you, like you say, got a very clean room. Don't get anything in there, any little speck in there of magnetic material jumps in at the end of the mat meter. So we're not going to worry about those things, Dick. But a couple of the military meters were like Eric described and all. In fact, let me let it drop.
The jewels loosen up in them. That's why they tip.
Damn right. And in fact, there was even one, I have one meter, that you have a range that sets the zero in the center of the meter. And so you can read positive and negative on that meter. It was also a surplus meter that you have a zero set in the center of the scale. So they had all versions of that. But no, they're not going for that. I advise the kids what to look for. Radio Shack, $10, $12, whatever is analog meter, or if Papa has a Simpson or a triplet laying around or something like that. Grandpa has one. You know, that's what stuff to go for. Forget about that stuff from back in the dark ages. Go ahead, Dick.
KC2QIQ with a comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just recently I was looking at some very, very inexpensive meters that were coming out of China. And the prices on them were like peanuts. I mean, a few dollars. It was amazing how inexpensive they were. And I found two different versions of them. Some of them I found are very, very similar to what you'd find in Radio Shack, which were the meter movement type. And the other types were the, digital type of meters, the LCD type meters. And what I found, which is kind of interesting, is that the LCD meters, the digital meters, actually were pretty accurate. I was surprised that they were fairly decent performance. I mean, not necessarily for a lot of AC measurements, but certainly for most DC measurements, measuring resistors, things like that. But I was also surprised to find out that the analog versions of these very, very inexpensive meters were not that accurate. Some of them were quite poor. But that's just something I've noticed recently, and I figured I'd offer that information. KC2QIQ.
Comment?
Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I agree with Glenn. You can buy a number of different measurement tools from China or from Hong Kong that are pretty much accurate. Let's say the the 8-digit frequency meter costs $67, and you pay probably $25 for the shipment. As far as the meters, I found some Chinese digital meters to be more accurate than Fluke. Another question that I have is, and it's for Lou, I'm very much surprised that nobody asked the question about what is a telescope and how to operate it. You can get them for $25 up to $75, 20 megahertz. Back to you, Dick.
An oscilloscope maybe is going to be the next piece of instrumentation. But I'm pretty sure that Mel is going to say, let's keep it simple. Let's use a volt-ohm milliammeter, analog meter, measure resistors first. Pretty soon we're going to be measuring capacitors next. And a couple of steps downrange we'll go into an oscilloscope. And that's quite a few steps ahead. An extremely interesting and very useful instrument when it comes to AC signals, alternating signals, whether they be sine waves, square waves, triangle waves, sawtooth waves, and so on. An oscilloscope is a very handy instrument, and if you want to see the quality of a square wave, you got to have an oscilloscope. You can't do it on a VOM. But when it comes to simple AC sine wave measurements and DC voltage measurements, a volt-ohm milliammeter, analog meter, very hard to beat. Very good training tool, very good first instrument to own. And one other thing we might want to measure, mention Mel, let me drop. I think I've seen it on some models of Simpson and some models of triplet. There's two other switches on the front panel that if you forget about them could get you into a little bit of trouble. And that is, one of them is a rotary switch where you click it to the left or click it to the right, it reverses the polarity of the two leads. So you don't have to switch the leads or unplug them. You just flip that switch and it does it. And another version of the volt-ohm milliammeters have a times 2 scale where you flip that switch and you think you're on the 3-volt full scale, and you're really on 1.5-volt full scale, a times 2 scale, and you got to worry about somebody flipping that little rotary switch somewhere in the corner of the meter, and your readings will become kind of crazy if you don't know about that. I wonder if you've seen either of those two auxiliary switches that are some models of Simpson and Triplett. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, well, the Triplett, the Simpson 260, has up there on the left, all of them had that minus, the later one. The original one only had DCAC, but, and oh, wait, they had one output, but just leave it on plus DC. That's what I said to them. The old one had DC, AC, output. And but I'm not going to get into explaining why and where. The one that you're talking about has minus DC plus DC, AC, and then a control to zero the meter. That's it. Let's leave it at that, and then just the range is fixed. Let's not get any complicated more than that. Anyhow, they're all asleep, so you're talking about already, you know, instruments. And but the Radio Shack, we used to buy a lot of that cheapy meters because just for the guys to check, be able to make a couple of simple checks to carry them around, because the meters never lasted more than, if some lasted a few weeks, maybe a month or two before they were lost. They were smashed and everything like that. So we used to buy the cheapies. They used to get them in the from Portage near the drop. For most of the testing that we did, they had to look for. In our case, most equipment was on 24 volts AC. Pick up 24 volts AC. In fact, what I essentially did, I made up my own instruments with LEDs for them to read out. So that. Simpler than the meters, because the meters, like I say, didn't last long. A meter movement was, or, and of course we weren't going to supply any digital type of VOMs, because that would be throwing the money literally in the garbage pail. So let's leave it at this simple VOM right now. We'll pick up on more exotic instruments way down the line. Those go, oh my God. I could say, thank God. You're not teaching the class, you have them all running out the door, Dick.
Yes and no. If I was teaching a class and the first two sessions are supposed to be on the use of a volt-ohm milliammeter to measure voltage out of a dry cell battery, a flashlight battery, or ohms of a table full of resistors, and all of a sudden on one side of the table I've got an oscilloscope that's turned on and there's a wave across that screen, guarantee that class is not going to run out of the room. They're going to say, hey, that is beautiful. Tell me what that is. And what I would do if I was running that class, Mel, is I would go through the procedures for using the volt-ohm milliammeter. I'd have the oscilloscope sitting at one corner of the room on the teacher's desk, and I would say for those who want to stay after class and they want to get a little bit of information ahead of time, I'll say a couple of words about this other thing over here. I mean, when something is as exciting as an oscilloscope, to a new person in electronics, an oscilloscope is a very exciting instrument, and it draws them in. So you'll keep the interest of some people that would be sort of bored by having that sitting there. They're not going to run away. One other thing I wanted to mention. Let me drop.
Kids don't have scopes yet. Wait, that's why I say wait.
I agree with that. That's a good point. If your meter, when you set it upright and you zero it, and then you lay it flat on the table and the zero shifts, Mel said that in theory you send it back to Simpson or Triplett and they rebalance the meter movement to correct that. You don't necessarily have to do that. All you have to know is that my meter is properly zeroed when it's laying flat on the table, therefore I'll always use it laying flat on the table if I want an accurate reading. And when it comes to accuracy, some of the better versions have a mirrored scale. So if you align your eye in such a way that when you look at the needle, the mirror image behind the needle is congruent with the needle that you're seeing, that means your eye is in the right position and you can believe the reading. and if your eye is skewed off to one side, you're looking at the meter edgewise, so to speak, you won't get this proper response out of the mirror scale, and you'll know that you're creating a little bit of error in the way you're reading the needle if the mirror scale does not come out right. So how many of the Simpsons or triplets that you have used have a mirrored scale to them, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, you got to remember, there was a number of models of the 260, and the 260 has gone through a lot of phases. If you want to just look at the 260, there was the basic, like I mentioned originally, the black one, you know, black case one with that style, and then they had, you know, one with mirror, like they had in that, it was 260-1, 260-2, on. And then the final one, I have one downstairs, it looks like, not like a 260. It's completely, it's got a more of a plastic front on it, you know, in other words, like a wider view of the, they took away that black frame around the meter, you know, the meter movement, and they made like a clear plastic all around, like a wider view with a mirrored scale, so. This is I don't know what, if they're still in production. Eric maybe can tell you. Are the Simpsons still in production at all? And if so, do they still have such a thing as the 260? If he's curious, I haven't kept up with it, Dick, to tell you the truth. Over.
And although it's a little bit ahead of schedule, I'm going to throw in one other comment. If you actually open up the screws on the back of the instrument, which you have to do in order to replace the flashlight battery inside. And the flashlight battery is only there on most of these volt-ohm milliammeters just to run the ohms scale. It needs a source of voltage to measure ohms. You've got to put a standard amount of current, so to speak, through the resistor in order to measure the voltage drop across the resistor in order to interpret its number of ohms of resistance. So you're opening up the meter to replace the battery, and you have to do that maybe once a year or so, depending on how many times you use the ohm meter scale. The nice thing about a triplet or Simpson volt ohm milliammeter is everything else is thoroughly passive. You can take that meter, you can trek up to Alaska, and you're in the cold and you've got no source of power, but that meter will run, and it'll measure AC and DC voltages to you for the rest of your lifetime if you don't abuse it. That's one of the beauties of the thing. The not-so-beautiful thing is the fact that it does create a little bit of loading. It puts a resistor across your circuit, and on a very high impedance circuit, you get a little bit of the so-called Heisenberg uncertainty problem. That is to say, your meters load down the voltage you're trying to measure, and the voltage you measure will be a little bit lower than reality, and you would get something much more accurate with a digital meter, because the digital multimeters all give you a 10 megohm constant input impedance. Let me drop. But while that case is open, in order for you to replace that flashlight battery, you look at the plug on the front panel that's labeled output, and you say to yourself, what in the world is that doing? Yeah, the owner's manual would tell you, but the owner's manual is never in your hand when you need it. And you look at that particular plug where you can take the leads on the front panel, and instead of plugging in into the normal common and plus lead, the red and black lead, you plug one of them into the so-called output lead. You say to yourself, what is that? And you see that there's nothing there but a coupling capacitor, usually a tubular or a paper-type capacitor. And the reason that was there is that when you're measuring AC voltage, like say, for instance, you're measuring the voltage on the tube anode, the plate of a tube, and you plug one of the leads into output instead of the normal way, you can now measure independently the amount of AC voltage, even though a DC voltage is present. That capacitor will not pass continuously a DC voltage, so the DC voltage that's on the plate gets wiped out, only the AC component that's left, and that is the output of the tube, so to speak, the AC output. So we're not going to go too deep into that now, but just know that that so-called output plug on the front panel just is a capacitive decoupling network that allows you to measure AC voltage independent of the DC voltage. If you are measuring AC with DC simultaneously present, you get a slightly crazy reading that requires a little more interpretation. That's as far as we're going to go with that one. And I know we've gone a little too far already. K2KEY, K2RIW, and we're about to pick up Steve. But you first, Mel. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, they still make Simpson 260. Got a cute little circuit breaker in it instead of the beard and the cape is yellow.
How about that? Go ahead, Mel.
I'm happy to hear if Simpson's still even in business. Gee, so many of them, all the instrument companies, most of them, so many of them fell by the wayside. Gee, it's unbelievable. I'd like to say I have to take a look at one of the new ones when I get a chance. Okay, let's leave output and all the dB scales and all that goodies for another time, Dick. Anyhow, everybody went to sleep. I have another subject here that I've been getting a lot of email on. First one, I'll tell you what, pick up one more, and then we'll get to, I would like to eliminate a few of these emails that I keep getting constantly, repeat performances on, because it seems to be a very popular subject, what I'm going to bring up next, Dick. Go ahead.
Okay, of the original guys who signed in, one of them was KC2MDP, Steve, and Jean-Luc, Steve, go right ahead with your question, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, Mel, thank you very much. You guys must have your crystal balls out tonight as far as oscilloscopes, because my next question concerns an oscilloscope, and here's what I want to do. Basically, I want to try and measure line noise on, regular 120-volt household current. You know, basically line noise generated from compact fluorescents, electronic ballasts, motors, all kinds of stuff like that, even switching power supplies, throw a certain amount of line noise on the circuit. My only question is I am one that is not too familiar with an oscilloscope. I have one sitting here. I have an Tektronix sitting here, but as far as the scale and how would I go about hooking it up? Would I use like a transducer, like a current clamp on that? Any question? Any comments you can make would help me out. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, a simple sounding question on this one, Steve, is unfortunately not quite as simple as you like. And if you do this one wrong, you can get in a fair amount of trouble. In order to measure any non 60 cycle sine wave component that's on your LIPA or Con Ed wiring of your house, at first you'd say putting a well adjusted oscilloscope onto that line and looking at that waveform and displaying that waveform as large as you can on that screen so you can look at any fine details that are present. An oscilloscope, by the way, is one way to do it. There are better instruments, but let's assume that you want to do it with an oscilloscope. Naively, you would say, okay, I'm looking at the voltage across the two blades of the plug in the wall, and I'm going to connect my oscilloscope there. Be careful. One of those blades is almost ground, it's the return, and one of them is hot. And the normal way to connect an oscilloscope is you've got the clip lead on the probe, which normally goes to ground, and you've got the center of the probe, which normally goes to the hot circuit. If you make the mistake of getting that backwards, and you put the clip lead for the ground onto the hot lead, your whole damn oscilloscope is now sitting at 120 volts AC. And if it's a metal-cased oscilloscope, and you touch that case and touch anything else that's grounded, I don't have to tell you what could happen. In the safest of all possible worlds, you'd like to have an isolation transformer with a real primary and secondary winding to make this measurement. Let me drop. But there's a catch there. If you've got a good oscilloscope that's got, let me say, 100 megacycle response capability, and you want to look for whether or not there's any extraneous noise up to 100 megacycles on your 120-volt line, that isolation transformer probably doesn't have frequency response up there, and it's going to give you a false negative. You're not going to see the extraneous signal. The elegant way to do this, if you had a real two-channel oscilloscope with two separate scope leads, and you connect one lead to the hotline and the other lead to the neutral, and you set up the front panel of the oscilloscope in the A minus B function. It's now looking at the voltage on those two probes and only displaying the difference between the two. Now that would be a safe way to do it without an isolation transformer. Most of us who are a little bit skilled with electronics will make the direct measurement. One single probe, one channel oscilloscope, connect the clip lead, the grounding lead of the oscilloscope probe onto the return or so-called neutral, the return wire, and that normally is the big blade, and the narrow blade is the hot one, and you put the oscilloscope center pin on the hot lead, and now you look at that waveform on the screen. With the oscilloscope set in the line sync mode. Let me drop.
Dig, actually, what you explained, he's going to blow his oscilloscope.
I have a couple of alternatives,
Dick. I have a couple of suggestions, too, Dick.
Yeah, Eric first, and then Glenn in that order. Eric, how would you measure with an oscilloscope any extraneous signal on the 120-volt line? Over to you, Eric.
I have a couple of methods. The best method, the simplest method, if you have a two-channel scope, it's the tectonic scope, you'll find that on one channel is an embed button. What you would do is you would take, first of all, I always like to plug the scope into an isolation transformer and leave the ground lifted. The isolation transformer that I use lifts the cage ground, because if by any chance the ground clip hits the hot side, the cage gets hot and you don't start, you know, during turn. But hook both probes to one side. Actually, start by hooking one probe to what you believe is the hot side, look at the time rate. Hook the second probe to the same connection, make sure you're inverse. Then you will have to adjust one of the channels to balance that out, to make that completely null out. Do that first. Then take the probe, hook it up to the other side, and you just completely do the differential, eliminate the AC part of it, turn the gain up as much as you want. Again, make sure that they're balanced, because even though the scope is supposed to be perfectly ready, it doesn't have that. And that's one method to do it. You only have a single channel scope. Again, hook the scope up to the isolation transformer, put it on a leather mat, make sure the case doesn't touch anything, and you can look at the sine wave and see noises there. You won't be able to measure them or get yourself an amplitude measurement unless you happen to have a scope that has a high pass filter function on the input channel, and there you could actually make a measurement. But that's one way to do it. Differential is the best way to do it, but always isolate the scope frame.
That's a step in the right direction, but still you got to be super careful, and there's one other danger you didn't mention, Eric, and that is if I'm using an isolation transformer that is powering the oscilloscope, so now the oscilloscope is, in theory, lifted from ground. That's the good news. The bad news is if it's an old-fashioned oscilloscope with a metal case, and if I hook up the single scope probe in the wrong way, so that now the whole metal case of this floating oscilloscope has 120 volts AC with reference to Earth on that metal case. And I put my hand on that case and touch anything else in the laboratory that's grounded. I don't have to tell you what could happen. So even that, although you're not going to get ridiculous currents flowing from the scope probe into the third wire, the neutral wire, the safety wire of the oscilloscope that's plugged into the wall, by the isolation transformer you've stopped that action. But still, I think there's a non-safety function here you might want to address, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, that's the whole point of putting the thing on a rubber mat. I mean, you are making yourself aware that you have the possibility of making that case hot. So, you know, you're on a rubber mat, or if you want to wear gloves, that's fine. If you're conscious of it, it's only for a quick measurement. You're not going to be leaving it there for somebody to touch. I also have a line noise analyzer, which is it's an $8,000 pump. If you want to go out and buy that, that's the perfect way to do it, because it's designed not only to measure noise, it measures the noise thing that measures the phase. If you happen to be doing three phase, it will give you a power functions. It will give you delta Y functions. But that's a very specific device. If you just happen to want to know that you've got a lot of junk, that's one way to do it. You're conscious of it. Yes, you could electrocute yourself very easily. Look, I work around, 28,000 volts in my transmitter. I could blow myself up very quickly. So, it's just a conscious thing. No, I don't recommend everybody do this, but you can do it.
Yeah, I'll give you a simpler way.
Yeah, before we go to Glenn and Mel in that order, Eric first, when you set channel A to normal performance and channel B into negative performance, connect the two together to the 110-volt line and balance them so that you get 0 volts, then do you put it with A being positive and B in the negative voltage mode, the reverse polarity mode, then do you set them into A plus B so that the differential is displayed on the screen, so that now you get a pure sine wave, if everything is great, of 120 volts, 60 cycle on the screen, one single sine wave with line sync function, so it sits still. Is that the way you would do the judgment of any excess noise on this particular oscilloscope? Because the ambiguity in what you said, Eric, is that you had the ability to do A minus B and sum them together so that you get a perfect neutral, and then the balancing act that you did so that nothing is on screen, balancing it only for 60 cycles and hope the high frequency comes through. I don't think that's what you meant, but I'm going to give it back to you to make that more clear. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Okay, sorry. You're right in that, is that the scopes that I use give you both functions at the same time. One's A plus B, one's A minus B. The point of the matter is that when you go across it, you're using the differential function to subtract any common mode of the 60 hertz. The hope is that when you have a line noise, that it's not equal on both sides. And I've never seen it equal on both sides, so... I've been able to track down sources just by doing that, and with a typical Tektronix scope, displays the addition and the subtraction on the same screen. So you get a good sense of what's going on.
Comment.
I'm going to give a couple of words. Eric, let's see now. We're going to be going to Glenn, Mel, and Alex. Wesley, in that order. There's one further thing that we've got to eliminate here, and that is, when Steve is looking for line noise, there's two different kinds of line noise, differential and common mode. And so some of these measurements, if you're smart enough to know what you're doing, you can detect one over the other. One kind of line noise is that if you had an ideal voltmeter and you put it across the two prongs of the plug in the wall, there should in theory be nothing there but a 60 cycle pure sine wave, no bumps to the sine wave, no other little squitters and whatever, pure sine wave, differential mode. Your particular line may pass that test. Let me drop. However, there is the possibility that there is a common mode. In other words, if I had a kind of noisy signal generator, and I wanted to add some extra noise to your particular line, and I've got one lead of my noisy signal generator connected to Earth, and the other lead by way of coupling capacitors for the high frequency component, I connect them to your hot lead and your return lead simultaneously, two separate capacitors coming together, connected to the output of my particular high frequency noise generator. I can now put the exact same voltage simultaneously on your hot lead and on your return lead. That would be a common mode voltage. Most of the things you would connect across that 110-volt line, like say, for instance, a high-definition television set, probably would not be sensitive to the common mode noisy signal, but would be sensitive to the differential mode. depending on how you set up your oscilloscope. In theory, you would like to know, is there any extraneous noise common mode? Is there any extraneous noise differential mode? You could say two different kinds of extraneous noise on your line. In theory, you'd like both of them to be zero, but if you measure one versus the other, it gives you another whole series of things you're going to do to correct it. So there's more than one kind of noise, even if you find the magnitude of the noise and the frequency of the noise. I'm getting a little deeper than I probably should, but it's something you should know about. Glenn next. Glenn, what were you going to say about all this? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm right on track with what you're saying here, Dick. I agree with you 100%. And that, you know, it's right now, the discussion here is common conducted emissions on a power line. And what's interesting is that you need to decouple the 60 cycle first in order to start looking at some of the higher frequency components. And most of the components that are really real nuisance on power lines is basically things from 150 kilohertz, pretty much to the 30 or 80 megahertz. Once you get past 100 megahertz, at that point, most of your stuff becomes radiated into different issues. And besides, most things on 100 megahertz on conducted power lines pretty much doesn't go very far. It kind of gets attenuated out on its own. So being that the discussion, one of the ways that I always measure this is with a device called an LISN, a Line Impedance Stabilization Network. You can find these things around. You can sometimes find them on eBay and other places. Where basically, this device is isolating the wall from the device, because you're really trying to see how much noise is coming out of your device. Let me let this drop for a second. But for measuring the noise coming out of the wall, in other words, how dirty is your wall outlet, basically you can use this line impedance stabilization network and reverse it. Put the load end on the wall, and then put a small resistive load, or a light bulb, something just like a light bulb, on the other side, and plug it in just to have a loading on the other side, so that now you're drawing some current through that wall outlet. That'll give you a much, much better idea. Now, typically, these kinds of measurements are made with spectrum analyzers, because you're looking for signals that can be a nuisance, that are very, very small in amplitude, that can really mess up equipment. Generally, I would say an oscilloscope, you're not going to see a whole heck of a lot, because you know, your average oscilloscope only goes down to like a 20 millivolt scale. I mean, you can get a really sensitive oscilloscope to go down to like a 2 millivolt scale, but typically what you really want to use is, with this measurement, is really a spectrum analyzer and an LISN. And, you know, you need some loading on that receptacle to really get a proper measurement there. K2RAW, KC2QIQ, just some of my thoughts.
Yeah, beautiful. Let me amplify some of what I think Glenn just said. Probably, if you're simply using an oscilloscope, measuring the quality of your 60-cycle, 120-volt line, and you properly display it with the proper setting up of the scope probes and whatever, differential mode, common mode, whatever, you got this beautiful sine wave on the screen, one complete, nice-looking sine wave, filling up the whole screen, left to right, top to bottom. You've adjusted the amplitude as high as you can without exceeding the maximum deflection on the oscilloscope, and you would like to think you now have simultaneously the ability to see how clean is the sine wave and are there any extraneous voltages on there. And with very good focusing of the beam coming out of that oscilloscope, so it's the finest possible line you could on the screen, and you've adjusted the brilliance, the focus, the astigmatism, you've done everything you can so you get the highest possible resolution on the screen. A rough rule of thumb with an oscilloscope is that you can only see a 30 to 1 voltage ratio, rough rule of thumb. That means if you've got this beautiful sine wave and another waveform is riding on top of it at some other frequency, if that waveform is 1/30th of the main sine wave, the 120 volts, and a good sharp eye will see it. If it's smaller than that, you will not see it. A 30th of a volt ratio is a 29.5 dB ratio. So in other words, if the extraneous noise is 29 dB weaker than that great big signal of 120 volts, on a simple oscilloscope, you might not resolve it. And that's something to worry about. If, for instance, in the room next to your room, somebody is running a piece of equipment with a switching regulator that's running at 100 kilohertz, and it's a real bad design piece of equipment that's putting 100 kilohertz spikes and square waves onto the 120 volt line. A real possibility. And if those spikes are 35 decibels weaker than the 120 volts AC,